One of the people teaching the first aid course said that, you know, head injuries aren't too serious because we only use 10% of our brains. And I thought, whoa, you know, actually, that's simply not true.
I hear it all the time.
If we conceive things different from what they are, then we would believe flimflams that are sold to us.
Have you seen these brain tuners?
No.
This is,
oh, no.
This is a brain tuner, apparently.
Impossible.
Myths about the brain and the way it works are everywhere, but I'm here to sort the fact from the fiction. In my quest for the truth, I've assembled a crack team of brain scientists, my neuro ninjas and no-nonsense mind myth slayers.
I'm Sarah Jane Blakemore from University College London.
Dr. Roy Cohen-Kadosh at the University of Oxford.
Eric Chudler at the University of Washington.
Sophie Scott, University College London.
Jessica Gron at the University of Western Ontario.
And Sergio Della Sala at the University of Edinburgh.
My neuroscientists, please stand by. For some reason, when it comes to the brain, there seem to be more myths than in other areas of science. Or maybe it's just that those supposed facts appeal to us, and so we remember them. That listening to Mozart makes us brainier. That if only we could become more right-brained, we'd be so much more creative, better versions of ourselves. Or, and this is one of my favourites, that the full moon disturbs the mind and even sends up the crime figures. You don't have to look far to find these myths in books, songs and films. Just this year we had the movie Limitless. The main character in that takes a drug which lets him access vast portions of the brain, which the rest of us apparently just don't use. Bringing us to our first myth.
We use only 10% of our brains.
So to get to the bottom of one of the biggest myths, I've come to University College London to an imaging lab, and there's an experiment going on at the moment, and behind the glass I can see the brain scanner there, and something's underway at the moment. And I'm joined by Professor Sophie Scott from the Institute of Cognitive Neuroscience. Now, one of the biggest myths is the idea that we only use 10% of our brains, leaving us that other lovely 90% to try to use somehow. Is there any truth in it?
There's actually no truth in it at all. The idea that there's sort of unused territory out there that is somehow sitting there inertly.
And if you look at a scan of someone's brain, can you see that there's lots more than 10% that's active?
Absolutely. And in fact, it's a bit humbling as a psychologist because you'd like it to be sort of things like, I don't know, complex thought that gives you the most activation in the brain. But if you really want to see the brain activated, get people to move their hand or talk, because control of motor output is really involves an enormous amount of brain activation. And that's because you're not just brain areas to do with planning the action, but also the brain areas to do with very specifically implementing how the muscles move.
So just clenching your hand would use more than 10% of your brain?
Yes, just clenching your hand would give you lots more than 10% of your brain. And clenching both hands would be even more. Functional imaging has shown us that there's very few parts of the brain that we can't see activated by something.
Also, when nerve cells aren't used, they are either taken up by other parts of the brain for a different function, or they degenerate, they go away, they die.
Eric Chudler says that the brain simply doesn't allow its cells to hang around doing nothing.
This is the old principle of use it or lose it. The brain is a very hungry organ in that it takes up a lot of the body's resources, almost 20% of the body's resources. So it's a very expensive thing to maintain. And so if the brain was so important, using so many of the body's resources, it would be very surprising if the brain wasn't actually using those resources.
And you'd have to wonder why we'd evolve to have a brain so big that it can cause, well, you know, death during childbirth if we didn't actually need that brain.
That's right.
It's an idea that's snappy and sort of sounds sexy, and I think it comes from the self-help literature, the idea that you've got all this untapped potential. It stayed really firmly in the culture. I went on a first aid course a few years ago, and one of the people teaching the first aid said that, you know, head injuries aren't too serious because we only use 10% of our brains. And I thought, whoa, you know, actually, that's simply not true. And he said, well, what am I doing right now? And I said, well, you're standing up, you're breathing, you're listening to me, you're not falling over, you know what your name is, you know, that's all being done in your brain somewhere.
Do you ever get people finding out you're a neuroscientist and then asking you about the 10% of the brain and whether it's true?
Yes, and I can't say, going back to the guy who was the first aider, it always ends prettily because he was upset and angry with me and thought I was a revolting show-off.
This is something that really seems to be out there. It's a myth that is very much believed by many, many people and not really questioned even.
But is the reason many of us don't question it that there's a teeny tiny grain of truth in it somewhere? Sarah Jane Blakemore wonders if the 10% myth originates from a very small, very rare group of people with very unusual brains.
There are reports of patients who happen to have a brain scan that normal people, healthy people who have jobs or are students or whatever, they happen to have a brain scan for one reason or other. It turns out that their brain scan is completely shocking because it shows that they only have a tiny fraction of their cortex. And they've managed to get this far only with a tiny fraction of their brain. And the logical conclusion is, oh, well, you only need a tiny fraction of your brain then to perform everyday functions normally. But the problem with that argument is that the brain is very clever at adapting to changing circumstances. It's very plastic and moldable. So in other words, if you're born with, say, only a fraction of your brain, then it will, in some cases, be able to adapt to that and still function quite normally. But that's a very unusual circumstance. Most of us have a complete brain and use all of that.
Eric, have you been able to establish where it is that this myth started?
It's possible that the myth originated with a famous psychologist named William James, who was very influential in the field of psychology. In 1908, he published a manuscript where he mentioned that we only used a small portion of our mental and physical resources, but he never mentioned a particular percentage of the brain that was being used or not. In the 1930s, a book was written by Dale Carnegie called How to Win Friends and Influence People. Dale Carnegie was a best-selling author, a self-improvement author, and in the foreword to his book, he did mention this 10% of the brain myth. I think that the public would like to believe that they could better themselves by improving the way that the brain is used. And they can. We can always learn new things. We develop new memories throughout our lives. But it's not because we're tapping into some unused portion of the brain. Rather, it's because we're forming new connections between nerve cells, or we're losing connections between nerve cells. But it's not by tapping into some previously dormant area of the brain.
Now, I've just come out of a bookshop where I've been trying to improve my mind. I was in the self-help section and found some interesting titles, books which promise a lot. It seems if only I can turn on my right brain, I'll be able to get organised, free up my life, enhance my artistic confidence, channel my inner wisdom, reach a higher consciousness, and even rule the future. Hope so. Now, we learn at school that anatomically the brain is divided into two halves. There's the left hemisphere and the right. But is there really any more to it than that? I sense another mind myth coming into range.
The left brain is logical and rational. The right brain is intuitive and creative.
So what is the truth about the two halves of the brain? In the popular mythology, those amongst us who are logical, dare I say nerdy types, are most reliant on their left brains, whereas touchy-feely artistic spirits use their right brains more. It's left-brainers versus right-brainers, or so they say.
I find it quite frustrating because there are really big differences between the left and the right sides of the brain, but that's never what people actually mean when you hear the terms used sort of out in a wider discourse. So left brain and right brain seem to be used almost as metaphors for different kinds of styles of thinking, almost always valenced in that sort of somehow left brain thinking is bad and right brain thinking is good and right brain thinking is creative and left brain thinking isn't. And that's very frustrating because there are really interesting differences and they're just completely not addressed by that sort of a trope, as it were.
Yeah, left brain, right brain is something that I hear a lot of, especially in the context of education. So I'm interested in the links between neuroscience and education. And in that context and in that world, this idea that, you know, some people are more left-brained, some people are more right-brained, is very prominent.
There's another kind of idea that you find bubbling around, that somehow the two hemispheres can be out of sync with one another, that we can have some way that they're operating together that's somehow unhealthy, and that you can do things that correct this. And again, that's just doesn't really speak to what we're really seeing in the brain.
Is there any truth in the idea of the logical left and the intuitive right-hand side of the brain?
There is some evidence that different regions in the different hemispheres have slightly different roles to play. But you will never see one hemisphere working by itself in the kind of normal, healthy brain. It's only when one hemisphere is lesioned, for example, by a stroke or something like that, that then you start seeing the other hemisphere working by itself.
Clearly, from the patient literature, there are differences between the left and the right sides of the brain. So very crudely, the majority of people, so 97% of people who are right-handed, have got language on the left side of the brain. And in fact, 75% of people who are left-handed still have language on the left side of the brain. The left side of the brain is the language organ for most people. And by that, I mean it's really important in understanding speech and in controlling speech production. There are other things that the right hemisphere is really good at. So the right hemisphere is particularly good compared to the left at, say, doing things with sequences of sounds that have a melody. So when you listen to somebody talking, to put it crudely, the left side of the brain really cares about the words somebody says, and it doesn't really care about much else. So the left side of the brain doesn't even care, it's a robot speaking, as long as there are words there and sentences. The right side of the brain really cares about voices. It likes things that sound human. It likes things that have pitch variation. It likes things that have got emotion in there. It's particularly sensitive to speaker identity. So it's when you're just doing the simple task of listening to somebody, your brain's already dealing with that in two different ways. The left side, on the whole, is dealing with the straightforward linguistic stuff, and the right is dealing with all the other stuff that you actually need if you're going to really interact with somebody in terms of, say, recognise who you're talking to or be able to understand the prosody with which they're speaking.
But still, it's not as if the left and right brain are these two isolated organs working separately from each other. They communicate all the time. For a start, they're joined.
We have this very complex set of fibres called the corpus callosum, which connects the two hemispheres together. So anything that your left hemisphere processes, your right hemisphere will know about it within a few milliseconds. So to say some people are more logical and left-brained and they need to use their or exercise their right hemisphere more doesn't really make any sense.
It sort of suggests that you could be using one hemisphere more than the other, and that's not really how it works.
In fact, creative endeavours and logical problem-solving draw on areas on both sides of the brain. Oxford neuroscientist Roy Cohen-Kadosh gets out his transcranial electrical stimulation device.
So, Claudia, I have here two electrodes, and I'm going to put them on your skull.
He's wiring up my head using equipment at the heart of an experiment he did last year.
Oh, it's cold.
Yeah, sorry.
That's right.
This study on mathematical abilities targeted weak electrical currents at particular areas of the brain. The idea was to give some extra oomph to nerve cells in those places.
This electrode's going to cause your neurons to fire much easier.
In the real experiments, a little electrical boost improved the scores of people doing various maths puzzles. And the reason I'm interested is that it didn't only work on the logical left side.
We stimulated the right and the left hemispheres. And we found out that it's actually both hemispheres that are important in order to be good with mathematical tasks. It's your brain and you need two for tangos.
So scientists see a complicated relationship between the left and right brains. But if people suggest otherwise, why get upset about it? Sergio Della Sala.
If we conceive things different from what they are, then we would believe flimflams that are sold to us through books or DVDs, or even worse, in programs that schools may buy. There are programs in the UK based on this dichotomy, whereby kids in school are asked to learn how to develop the creativity of the right hemisphere. I was flying to Paris recently, and there was the InFlight magazine, and there was an advert there for CEOs. $400, and you learn how to use better your creativity in the right hemisphere. The life coach was proposing a system whereby she would teach you to breathe through your left nostril, so the oxygen goes up to the right hemisphere, and it stimulates the right hemisphere. The fact that the air goes down to the lungs was a bit of a glitch in the system, but it's a minuscule little thing.
We're very seduced by neuroscience, so it's not good enough to say some people are creative and others are more logical. Putting a kind of brain basis on that is somehow very seductive and captures people's imaginations. Giving it a biological basis somehow solidifies it and makes it more convincing. People will find that explanation more satisfying just because it has got some words about the brain, like the prefrontal cortex or whatever. And I think this might be where this tendency to kind of grasp onto left brain versus right brain comes from. People believe it more if it has a biological brain explanation.
Some people who use the left brain, right brain idea on management courses, say, will argue it doesn't matter if it's not strictly speaking true, because it just gets people to think in a new way and gets them to be a bit more creative. And if that's what you're trying to do on a course, then it doesn't matter.
Well, as a neuroscientist, I think it matters. On the other hand, as long as they're honest about that and say there is actually no neuroscientific evidence that this is based in what we know about how the brain works, then I guess that's fine.
But if you're telling people it's true, then
well, that's
different.
Not good.
I can see that they're using it as a metaphor. I suppose where I become uncomfortable is because it just seems to be a metaphor that's fundamentally wrong. So it's not really a metaphor in that sense. I would like that understanding to be based on something that was actually correct.
So there are some differences between the left and the right, but they work in concert. And so the idea that we're either left or right brained just doesn't stand up. Now onto one of the most famous myths of the mind.
The Mozart effect. Listening to Mozart makes you more intelligent.
The concept of the Mozart effect is the idea that classical music, in particular that composed by Mozart, might have long-term benefits for thinking ability, for mental function, when you play it to children and even young babies.
They thought that there perhaps was something in the rhythms of music of Mozart that tapped into some of the same functions that higher reasoning also used. And so they thought that by almost priming certain brain circuits with music would enhance some cognitive abilities.
In fact, there is no scientific evidence whatsoever for any long-term benefits for babies.
Jessica Grant studies the effect of music on the brain and knows where this myth came from.
In 1993, a researcher called Dr. Rauscher and her colleagues were interested in the effect of music on what they called spatial-temporal abilities. And so they did a study with undergraduates, not with children, where they asked them to listen to some Mozart. Or to a relaxation tape. Or just to sit in silence. And then they gave them a series of tests. And one of these tests, just to give you an example, involves looking at how a piece of paper is folded up, and then you make little cuts in it. And your job is to guess how that will look when you unfold it. So what sort of snowflake pattern you're going to get. And what the study found was that after listening to Mozart, people were better able to guess these sorts of things than after listening to a relaxation tape or just sitting in silence. Now, what's interesting is they didn't make any claims about this being more than just a temporary effect, and it was just a few intelligence points that were gained by these students. But what was interesting is the Associated Press was calling Dr. Rauscher before she even knew the study had been published. This was just such an interesting phenomenon to the press that they leaped on it. And that paper got more press coverage than any other paper in the journal Nature that year.
Sloppy reporting of this research, along with media misinterpretation of other experiments with classical music, snowballed into the Amadeus Enhanced IQ myth.
There's really no evidence to suggest that listening to any music makes you smarter. But that has not stopped commercial enterprises from trying to push it onto new parents to play music for their babies. Several years ago, in a state in the United States, there was a governor who commissioned, I believe it was 100,000 CDs that he gave out to his constituents, mothers of newborn babies. He thought that having this music and playing it for their babies would cause his population essentially to become smarter.
So if there isn't evidence that it actually works, how are we to explain the findings from the original experiment in 1993? The people who listened to the Mozart music did do better at getting the shape of the origami snowflakes. How come?
Several scientists followed this up just to try and look at what was going on here. So they found evidence for a Schubert effect, if you preferred Schubert over Mozart. And they even took some of these studies to children to look at what the effects might be. There was a very interesting study done in the UK with 10 and 11-year-old children, and they actually found that listening to pop music improved performance on these sorts of tests more than listening to Mozart.
Now, for instance, we wrote a paper called The U2 Effect, comparing performance on listening to Mozart music versus other music, and there is no difference whatsoever. You can have a noise, a banging on the table, you have the same effect. Any little noise will produce a bit of alertness, but there is no lasting effect, and certainly there is no effect specific to Mozart music.
So what is the explanation for why they did better straight afterwards? It's just attention, is it, that you pay attention, you become more alert?
Yeah, of course.
It was about the energizing and enjoyment that you got out of listening to music in general. And this happened to, you know, have knock-on effects short-term, 10 to 15 minutes, on people's performance.
Does it matter that it's a myth that it will do anything long-term or a myth that it will help children or babies?
I think that depends on your perspective. In some senses, introducing music into the curriculum or sending newborn babies home with Mozart CDs probably does no harm whatsoever. However, if significant amounts of money are being diverted to these programs without any evidence for them having effects, and that money is being taken from programs that do have evidence for enhancing cognitive function, you are running into problems.
Once we have an effect to which we give a name, everybody believes it's true. I was in south of Italy recently visiting a mozzarella farm. If you eat mozzarella, you appreciate that.
Lovely, yeah.
Ah, fantastic. And you know that mozzarella comes from buffalo's milk. Uh-huh. And they have all these buffaloes in this place, very clean, and they were claiming that everything was very natural, so they have trees for them to scratch their back. And they were playing Mozart music 3 times a day, so the milk would be better. As if in the wild, you have this buffalo with iPod on their ears and listening to Mozart music.
Jessica, in your work on how music affects the brain, have you found any areas where music can have long-term effects?
It certainly seems that learning to play a musical instrument and putting in the hours of dedicated practice required to really master that instrument does have effects on the brain.
There have been some studies which have trained children to play music on keyboards. And that musical training over a long period of time does seem to have a beneficial effect that does translate into academic performance.
Having a year of keyboard or voice lessons increases IQ points by 3 or 4 points.
So learning to play an instrument, learning to play music may have some beneficial effects that passive listening to music doesn't have.
The media surrounding the Mozart effect is absolutely incredible, and I think it's because we really like the idea that there's this shortcut and it's an art form, so that this art form might have enriching effects above and beyond just pleasure, I think really grabs us. And the idea that, again, we could be doing our children some additional benefit that's going to set them up for a successful life is also just a bit too irresistible.
Full moon increases the incidence of abnormal behavior.
Hello, moon, can you hear me?
Is it true that there are more admissions to psychiatric hospitals and more crimes committed when there's a full moon?
The majority of studies do not find that there's a relationship between any abnormal behavior, including assaults, arrests, murders, suicides, calls to crisis centers, poisonings, vehicle accidents. Most of the data, and there has been many studies, find that there is not an association between the phase of the moon and any of those abnormal behaviors.
By the silvery moon.
So do you have any idea how this myth has come about? I mean, obviously, you know, werewolves, the idea of that goes back a long way.
Right. Just the word lunacy comes from luna, meaning moon. So the moon does affect behavior. The moon elicits books, movies, poems have been written about the moon. And so the moon is a very romantic, mysterious thing to think about. When something traumatic happens, having the full moon allows someone to give meaning to a very stressful event. So, for example, the people that believe that the moon does have an effect on abnormal behavior are mainly law enforcement and people in medical fields. And you can imagine that they are exposed to very stressful conditions. They see horrific things. When these things happen and there is a full moon, people attend to the phase of the moon. And they say, oh, it's a full moon tonight and this particular event happened. But they don't pay attention to the same things that happen at other times of the month when the moon is not full.
Hello, moon, can you hear me?
My wife's sister, who's actually a police officer, she will swear that she pulls more people out of the ditch when the moon is full than at any other times of the month.
The moon is magic. It's wreaking heaven on my emotions.
But when I ask her, have you ever pulled anyone out of the ditch when it has not been a full moon? She say, oh, that happens too. But she never keeps track of it and never associates a quarter moon or a half moon with these traumatic events.
Yeah, it's making me crazy, that old emotional moon.
So don't worry about the full moon giving you a funny turn, and don't breathe through your left nostril in the hope of a creative surge from the right side of the brain. If your brain is normal, both sides are tangoing in harmony, whether you're writing a poem or calculating your income tax. And that's most of both hemispheres, not just a measly 10%. I've sorted the facts from the fictions, but if you don't have a team of neuroscientists to turn to, it's easy to fall into the trap of believing the myths. Sergio Della Sala with some final words of counsel.
I don't say you believe in bizarre myths and we don't, we're clever. What I say is that we all believe in bizarre things. I believe in bizarre things. I believe Italy will win the rugby world championship. As the Queen of Hearts used to say in Alice in the Wonderworld, everybody believes at least 9 bizarre things before breakfast. I urge people not to believe me, but to look at the data, to check it out, to inquire, be skeptical.